This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the podcast about how and why popular music happens, hosted by Nate Wilcox. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to all the other great Pantheon podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes Stephen Blush to discuss his book, American Hardcore, A Tribal History. Nate and Stephen talk about the angry, loud, and disaffected scene of the early 1980s, which managed to change the course of American culture despite the active opposition of the music industry. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today I'm joined by Stephen Blush, author of American Hardcore, A Tribal History. Stephen, thanks for coming on the show.
Great to be here. It's really great to be here.
And so this is a very important piece of work. You did a book in two editions. I think it came out in 2002 and then again in 2010, expanded and updated. And you also did a documentary that came out 2006?
Right. So, you know, this is kind of like the story of my youth of, or, you know, my story growing up in many ways. Was my life was this scene that I kind of came up through, and it's kind of a long story, but the easiest way to describe it is my father worked in New York. My father worked right around in the Lower East Side and like the when the bad old days of the 70s, and right around the corner from CBGB's, right up the block from St. Mark's Place. So at a very young age, meaning like 12, 13, 14, I was going to these places to drink and I found record stores, and I discovered this whole scene, and which was punk rock, which was a very something that I really respected the whole thing, but I really loved the music, and I saw so many seminal shows coming up through my teens, but I didn't fully relate to it in that these people were older. These were people who'd gone to art school, kind of intellectuals, get junkies, none of that was really me. I didn't know that Bauhaus was an art movement. You know, when I first got there, I just knew it as a band. You know, that's kind of where I was coming from. So I was from the suburbs of New Jersey. I spent all my weekends with my dad, like I'm saying, at this, you know, in the Lower East Side. So I have this kind of double life where it's suburban and rock and roll. And I go down to college in Washington, D.C. in the fall of 1980. And there's like this whole new form of punk rock going on. It's spearheaded by the Bad Brains. And, you know, there's these new bands like the Teen Idol single had just come out when I was there, which is the precursor to Minor Threat. And these were suburban kids with their own form of revolution, social revolution. And I fell in with that. So I was not a musician. I was coming to college. I came to study politics at George Washington University right by the White House. And it was the inauguration of Ronald Reagan. So a lot of things were really coming to a head. And there was this movement, and Dead Kennedys put out these records, which were, you know, and this whole kind of anti-Reagan meets a new form of punk rock based on what the Bad Brains and a lot of the West Coast bands were doing, which was the emphasis on speed and energy, and it was physical. I was a kid who was, you know, a letterman in sports, but I never really fit in with the jock culture. So there was this whole thing kind of came, really spoke to me, but I wasn't a musician. So I was at a PSOL had come through on their first tour, and I met their manager, who was also the Dead Kennedys manager, and he convinced me to... I was a radio DJ at my college radio station. I was like the first kid playing these records on these labels like Discord and Touch and Go. I had Ian MacKay on my radio show, and basically because I was the only person, you know, connected to anything who was part of this very kind of feral punk scene. There was no press. There was no media attention, really. I mean, I had a college radio show, so, and I talked, you know, and Ian came on and played his records and gave me some. And since then, I met the manager of, since I worked at the radio station, I met the manager of the Dead Kennedys, and he convinced me to book the Dead Kennedys, and I booked them into my school cafeteria, and I almost got thrown out of college, but I did, but that kind of set me on this path, right? And I became the kid promoter in town. I did the Dead Kennedys a couple times. I did Black Flag, Circle Jerks. You can look it up, but I mean, certainly 20, 25 shows I did in my 4 years there. So, flash forward, I moved to New York. There was a burgeoning hardcore scene there, but there was also so much more going on in terms of. I had worked at the radio station, so I was able to get work as a DJ in New York nightclubs. So there was hip hop and club music and the dawn of what you would now call techno. And there's just, you know, there was just so much going on. And I started, I was an editor at Paper Magazine. I started my own fanzine called Seconds, which we did 52 issues of. So I was always a punk rocker, and I was always attached to this hardcore thing, but, you know, and of course speed metal, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, there was so many different areas that I was more interested in, but then there was this punk revival, like right after the grunge explosion, which I was tight with all those bands because those were basically hardcore kids that I had met on the road, you know, through the years, like Nirvana, Soundgarden,
and then the Bad Religion
Pearl Jam was,
yeah, and then the second wave, oh, yeah, of right, the punk right. revival in the 90s with a lot of bands cameo appearances in the book, like Bad Religion, that was totally a very minor band in the 80s, but stuck with it and had a record company, Epitaph, and in the 90s they become huge on their own label,
right?
But
it's really cool you say that, because that's exactly what it was kind of leading to, which is this punk revival kind of happens in the early 90s, and I had known Brett for Bad Religion. They would be like the fourth band on a Black Flag bill, you know, and I used to go see them at CB. There was a tour, I want to say it was 1988, and it was Bad Religion and L7, and you know, there was 50 people there, you know. So that was right before they went to, I think their story was they went to Germany and then it just exploded there. That's where they finally, so So I get to know all these bands like, well, there was a band in New York called D-Generation, which was kind of like the focal point of the punk scene in New York, and they had a club called Coney Island High. So the touring bands would come through. So that's, you know, you would get to know Green Day and Rancid and Offspring. And I had this connection through my writing with Epitaph during all those times. And, you know, so, but, so here's where I get to American hardcore, is that I start hearing people telling me the history of hardcore, you know, like this, the hardcore thing, you know, like people are like 10, 15 years younger than me. And that's not an ageist thing, but they just kind of had it wrong because
there wasn't
no real documented history. Sure, there were fanzines, but there was no Rolling Stone article. There was no anything on TV or broadcast. I mean, this was such a deep subculture. You know, this was like, I can't really explain. It's hard to explain subculture in the day, in the modern era, because what we're talking about is things that gestate for 10, 15 years, you know? So like my life from like 15 to 35 was incredibly underground. And in a minute it became huge, you know? It's like, you know, like I worked with like all those, like I'm saying, all the grunge bands, and, you know, and then there's this punk revival, which is, you know, so much bigger than even the English thing was. It's like the biggest thing of all. And anyway, so I was hearing a lot of history. I was seeing some of the bands go on. I'd interview a lot of these bands. I'm not going to name a couple of them, but I think I said one or two. I said one of them just before, but I was interviewing one of these bands, and it's like they don't know who I am, and they're telling me stuff about what, hey, I had very long hair at the time. This is kind of a fuck you to everybody. And I was like, and he's trying to school me on punk. And I'm like, and then there was this series of rock and history of rock and roll series on, I want to say it was PBS. It was like a, you have to look it up. It's kind of, it was like a 10 part series of the history of rock. And I watched this thing, and it goes from like the band X straight to Nirvana, like hardcore never even happened, you know? And I was like, because, you know, they just didn't even know, the people who made it probably just didn't even know about it, you know, or didn't even consider it, people didn't even consider this stuff music. It was like, you know, everyone talks about how the hell are you going to have a career, you know, making this stuff, you know? It's like, it's, you're not doing it for those reasons, you know? It's such a deeper thing than like, becoming a rock star, or, you know, it was like you were buying into something so deep. And I'm really just, you know, as I've been hit, you know, hit my 50s mark, it's like, you know, I realized like how powerful this whole thing was. It's like we were kind of like war, you know, like war veterans. Like you could pick up, like if you served with somebody, you can meet them 20 years later and pick up that conversation like it was yesterday. And I'm friends with people from all walks of life that I would never know if it wasn't for this music. Like everything I do dates back to this hardcore thing. And I think that was the focus of all the projects you just saw. And that's why it got so big. I will tell you a funny story, is that before I went to Feral House with my book, with American Hardcore, Adam, the late Adam Parfrey was a close friend of mine. But before that, I wanted to give it try a major to see if I'd get it on like a major publisher. And I didn't have a deal with somebody until I met the head of the company. And he said, hey, why don't you put Debbie Harry on the cover for American Hardcore?
That's classic.
And I just walked away from a, $60,000 deal and almost got myself sued by the agent. You know, so but there was no way I was doing that. And I took a very, you know, Feral House, you earn your money. They're a great company, but you know, as an independent, you earn what you make, you know, you earn what you sell. So American Hardcore book, I went on a tour. I'll tell you the book. I got a, I'm in New York City. We had an event, a little event on September 11th, 2001. I got my first copy of American Hardcore on September 10th. And, I didn't even know like what was going to happen with humanity, let alone the book. So, but I had planned a book tour. So I went left about, 30 days later, went off on a 2-month tour, which is like, I just did it like a band. Cause that's the only thing I really know what to do. So I would go to bookstores and I would go to record stores. I know I did a whole bunch of stuff in Texas. I just did it like a band. The editor, George Petros, and I it was like getting the van, you know. I worked out some scams that I was able to, went to car, went to truck with unlimited miles, and I used the unlimited miles, and we went to Seattle, and we went to, whatever, we did L.A., art galleries, rock shows, all ages gigs. And by the time I got home, well, maybe not 2 months, maybe about 5 weeks, actually. But anyway, by the time I got home by Thanksgiving/Christmas, the book had already sold out. And I knew that when I was writing this.
And it's like the book is a vitally important service that you've done in cataloging this history that was totally erased. Very little known in the first place. I mean, this was kids, a few dozen of kids in a couple dozen cities, a few dozen each. And in some cities, LA, you had a few hundred, maybe a few thousand people involved. But this was a minuscule scene of people photocopying fanzines, recording cassettes, tiny record labels pressing, editions of 2,000, 3,000, maybe sometimes 500. And, you documented it. And, I was in Borger, Texas in the 80s and got to see Black Flag in 86 and Husker Du in 87. We were very desperate for news. It took us a month and a half to find out that D. Boone of the Minutemen had died in late 85. So there was no internet. It was very hard to get information about this stuff. And one of the groups that I had never heard of until your book was this band we're about to play, Middle Class, which their single Out of Vogue is considered by many to be one of the two first hardcore punk singles. And let's hear it. This is Middle Class, Out of Vogue. Was Middle Class Out of Vogue, which many consider to be one of the first hardcore punk singles. And like many of their hardcore brethren, they came out of the greater LA suburban area. LA had a punk scene. It was one of the few cities in the US that immediately took up the baton once the CBGB scene in New York had exploded, and then punk, exploded big in England. And LA took up the mantle with bands like X that you mentioned, but also Germs and Fear. In a lot of ways, they were precursors to hardcore. They tended to be older and more educated, and the Hollywood crowd was a little more artsy. But there were elements in that LA punk scene that pointed directly to where hardcore was going.
For sure. I mean, that's LA. I mean, I don't mean anything disparaging of the LA punk bands, but they had the energy. But what they didn't have was the work ethic of the bands that came from more of the suburbs around them, which were, of course, was like Black Flag and Bad Religion, all these guys who started their own bands and labels themselves.
and toured and toured and toured. Like a band like Black Flag were just notorious workaholics. Greg Ginn starts this in a church in Huntington Beach, which was absolutely Siberia culturally, as far as, you know, the media elite and downtown LA was concerned. And doing things like practicing 8 hours a day. You know, there's a story in the book about Black Flag booking a rehearsal studio on Christmas Day to practice all day long. And just, you know, getting in the van and touring. And they had sort of a Johnny Appleseed quality where everywhere they went, and they're basically calling random people up and trying to get any place to play. They're playing in rec rooms and basements and abandoned buildings, and everywhere they go, a scene sort of seems to follow in their wake.
Yeah, I don't know if Black Flag, the power of Black Flag, is completely translated to vinyl for the modern era, but I can say that that was definitely the most intense band I've ever seen, and it was cult-like almost. It was I saw them probably close to 20 times, and I've later learned that a lot of what Greg Ginn was doing was not musically, but business-wise, emulating what the Grateful Dead had done, which was the ultimate anti band for anybody who loved hardcore, but they were a self-contained touring machine, and that's what, who had their own gear and put it, you know, controlled their records, and, you know, records weren't the most important part of their thing, so that aside, such an important band, and really, all the bands you mentioned before, of course, were on, they started on Black Flag's label, right? So,
yeah, and that comes
incredible.
And that one thing that comes through in the book, and I think you do a good job of setting the scene, and you talk about some of the sort of generic factors of hardcore as a movement, things, you know, like the context of Reaganism and coming up in the early 80s when the majority culture is trying to have this Morning in America moment that's totally fabricated and fake, and we're living with the consequences of that, you know, the decision to ignore Jimmy Carter's, you know, attempts to do something about the energy crisis and climate change, and Reagan was just like, screw that, we're going to spend the grandkids' money and have a big party, and we did, but, you know, hardcore was fun for those kids who, for various reasons, were disaffected and called bullshit on all that, and, you know, and then things like, it's a very violent scene, mostly because it's young dudes. It tends to be overwhelmingly male, although it wasn't necessarily explicitly sexist. There had been bands in punk like the Dead Boys or Fear that were explicitly sexist, but hardcore is almost more asexual than sexist. And
yeah, I try to make that point. You know, it's like, I think if there was a chapter that bothered a lot of people I knew, or troubled some people I knew, from the book, was where I have to just ask the obvious question, okay, what is this with a bunch of guys with no shirts on jumping on top of each other, right? So, yeah. You know, but it is more asexual is the answer. It's like football in that way. Like, and I kind of got that part of it, just the camaraderie and the mucking around aspect of it.
Yeah, and there was elements of homophobia. There was certainly violence against homosexuals, but I think in the context of the overall culture, which was just an incredibly homophobic society, even more than we are today, and very violent. That's another thing I don't think younger people realize is, if you shaved your head and put on an anarchy jacket, you were basically asking for an ass whipping anywhere in the United States.
100%. I mean, you're in Texas, so that's, you know, I mean, that carried on for much longer for, you know, the late 70s, early 80s, you know, so it was, and I remember, you know, the reaction when it stopped, you know, to get cast in Palestine, Texas or something, you know. I really feel like, it was like an empowerment movement, really. And I don't say that lightly.
I mean, look at what was created by a bunch of dudes who, you know, I mean, think about, like, if you just cumulatively put, I don't know, Greg Ginn, Ian MacKay, I don't know, whatever. You take five of it, Glenn Danzig, take five of these people and the Bad Brains, whatever. Put five of these people together, like, how much they changed the world.
Yeah.
And it's staggering. It's really like a staggering thing. And, I, you know, to go to DC and have, you know, this rising, I guess you would just call it the early Discord era. You know, some of the bands weren't, you know, some of the bands were better than the other, but at a certain point it's silver or gold, you know, it's like, they're both good, you know, the energy. I mean, I remember I was out with No Trend and we were on a tour. We were opening for the Dead Kennedys. We did like about 10 dates across the country with them. COC was actually one of those bands, Reed Mullen, rest in peace. I remember when we played a club show in Norman, Oklahoma, the band who opened for us, it was their very first show, was Flaming Lips. So, and I know when we played in, Seattle, like the second or third band on the bill was Soundgarden. And so, you know, it, definitely, it's heavy, you know, like the roots of it is so deep, you know.
It was a movement that had no support from the music industry. In fact, it had active opposition from the music industry. Clubs were not booked hardcore bands.
I could have been very successful in the music career if I didn't keep that hardcore punk rock thing, you know. But, you know, it's an aesthetic that you, that people hated at the time. It wasn't like you didn't have a chance. It was like, you know, I had kind of like messy hair, you know, and some scraggly clothes that would sit in a punk show, but it was hardly, like, I didn't have a mohawk or anything like that. And I was still constant, you know, hey, Devo, you know, like, they didn't even know what to call you back then, you know? Like, you know, I fought more in those years than every year put together, even as, like, an 8-year-old, you know, where you probably fight your most, and,
yeah.
I would be, like, I definitely fought more in, like, those, like, you know, 18 to 20, what, like, 16 to 20 years, just defending myself for, like, being into this stuff, you know?
And it was like the effect of a cultural depth charge. It took, fuses were lit in the early 80s and connections were made, and it took time for the greater culture to feel it, but eventually in the 90s and on into now, it's still reverberating. And let's hear Black Flag's version of Louie Louie, which is just a classic case of taking rock history and throwing it in people's faces. This really pissed people off at the time. This is Des Cadena leading Black Flag to Louie Louie. Yep. And that was Black Flag's infamous cover of the Richard Berry classic Louie Louie, which had a big impact at the time. I mean, that was on a Rhino Records compilation of different versions of Louie Louie that included, you know, the Beach Boys and the Kinks and marching bands. And so in certain ways, Black Flag in particular around 81 with their Damaged album was flirting with some acceptance. I mean, they're playing shows in L.A. where 2,000-3,000 people are coming out. And they briefly signed this deal with Unicorn, which was a shady subsidiary of MCA, the major label, and it looked like they were going to square the circle and get major label distribution for a totally underground album, but it all fell apart. What happened there?
Yeah, I was around for a lot of that stuff. It was basically like, it's kind of like what you had just said about the music business. Nobody really wanted to deal with it. You know, they didn't even want to really even make money on it. They kind of, you know, it wasn't like really enough money for them to like shake their own values, you know? But anyway, Black Flag seemed like this really big band from the outside. And as I got to know them right around this, I had seen them. A real turning point for me was it's called the Valentine's Day Massacre. So I guess it was Valentine's Day of 1981. And it was Black Flag with Vince Cabina came to D.C. and SOA with Henry Rollins was one of the opening bands. So, and that was like deep D.C. hardcore culture. And that night I met Greg and Chuck and them and Robo. And I remember like being backstage, and what was weird about it was like everyone was kind of all these really intense dudes, like they're eating the pies or whatever, were like kind of, if the way I remember it was, I mean, I don't know if he was one of them, but I just remember a whole bunch of like skinhead dudes like literally sitting on the floor listening to them talk. Like that's how powerful, how inspirational this band was. And then they came through about, I didn't really know Henry at that point, but I knew who he was from seeing him. But I, you know, about 6 months later, he ends up as the singer of the band, and they came to D.C. And then that's about when I started going to see them a lot. And from the outside, it looked like this big, big thing. Flash forward a couple of years later, but still the same vibe. Black Flag was playing a huge show in New Jersey. At a certain point in Black Flag's career, they didn't even play New York and LA. They just played the suburbs. That was like the mission. You know, so you would get a Black Flag tour with 4 or 5 shows in New Jersey. And so I would, I remember like thinking this is the biggest band in the world, and I take them back to my house and let them rob my mom's pantry for food. You know, so she's never forgotten that either. Black Flag walking in her house and raiding her pantry.
Yeah, and should I get... The deal, go ahead.
Yeah, so I don't know too much about the business. A guy who would really know that kind of stuff would be someone like Joe Carducci, or like one of those kind of guys would know
that
exact business side. He does tell me a bunch of it in the book, but I don't know all the details. But the way it's described in the book, if I remember, it's like they had this distribution deal where it was like they could still be an underground band and be on MCA at the same time, but that actually didn't work because you really need to be on MCA. Like they're not really going to care about you unless you're... That's the problem with a lot of distribution deals in businesses in general. At the end of the day, they're just distributing you. You're not their product. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And MCA...
I think it was something like that. So, and then they, but what really complicated things was, there's this point where they actually, and this might be the only musicians I know this story of, but for their music, they were thrown in jail. They went before a judge in a case of, and they, the judge didn't like this band, but he saw a bunch of like these freaks, you know, see these dudes, scruffy dudes walk in, and you know, they spent a few days in jail. They put out this record called Everything Went Black, where they actually don't, where they cross out the name Black Flag. It all had to do with their contract with MCA somehow. That's why I said that part I don't know.
Well, yeah, but, there was an injunction against them,
right.
in their lawsuit with Unicorn Records, and they literally could not perform or release any records for like 18 months at the peak of their popularity.
Right. So, and that was a very critical time too. It was like, that's when the whole thing was exploding. That's when hardcore was exploding. So they got kind of fucked up because there's actually like it doesn't seem like it now, but there was a long lag time between Damaged and My War. And My War is almost like a different, it's like a different thing. I don't know if you've, if you go online, you could find the My War demo, which is, has
absolutely
it's on drums. That's one of the great recordings to me, hardcore, punk, whatever, you know, recordings ever. But somehow they made the record with, Greg also playing bass as well as guitar under a pseudonym. So,
yes,
I don't know.
Dale Nixon.
That punch. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, and while the band is fighting this lawsuit, and they fought it brilliantly, they ended up destroying Unicorn Records, and the judge had to throw out the case. But in the meantime, Ginn has basically chased off, you know, Des Cadena, the second guitarist and former vocalist, quit. Chuck Biscuits, the great drummer that they poached from DOA, quit. Chuck Dukowski, the, you know, to me, half of Black Flag, the bass player, is pushed out because he can't keep perfect time to Greg Ginn's specifications. Right. And like you say, that demo, the My War demos with two guitars, which is how it was written for, and Chuck Biscuits on drums, is this incredibly powerful document. But instead, we get My War with overdubbed bass and really thin production, and it's the beginning of thinner and thinner sounding records from Black Flag, and also the beginning of a very confrontational relationship between Black Flag and their audience. The original Black Flag was confrontational with the greater society, but by the time they're doing instrumental albums, you know, of Stone jams and Henry Rollins doing spoken word poetry and putting out you know, three records a year, it was
and
very
growing their hair really long, like if each. It was a pre-internet era, so you may not have known, you know, that Chuck Dukowski wasn't in the band with his shaved head on Damage. You were getting like, you were hearing like a ZZ Top before they went on stage. You know, they were just fucking with everybody. They had long hair, they're playing black. And the other big one was Mob Rules and Heaven and Hell by Black Sabbath with James Dio.
The deal,
so they would play these records before they went on. They would grow their hair long. People would like sucker punch Henry. This is where I really gained my respect for Henry Rollins, and I will never, ever say anything bad about the guy because he took so much shit as the fucking singer of Black Flag. Like, I remember, like, he'd come out, like, with, like, long hair and Speedos, barefoot. Kids would be, like, you know, like, be reaching into the crowd with his long hair flying. Kids are, like, lighting his balls on fire with a lighter or, like, pulling the hairs on his leg. You know, it was so nasty. But it was so punk. And it was so, you know, I mean, it was like the natural road, you know. It's like, as I said, this was like a cult. You know, you were buying deep into, if you got into Black Flag, it never ended. You know, there's a bunch of people in the city who are pretty well known who are related to Black Flag, and it's still, we have that connection. I mean, we're still always talking about Black Flag.
Yeah.
Because they were that intense.
It had that effect. So, you know,
I'm a big Greg Ginn fan. I mean, I know, I get it. I know he needs a singer. I know what he's done wrong. I've seen him with five people at a club. I mean, but I respect the guy. He was the most punk of all of them. You know, he like set the bar so high that no one, you know, it kind of fucks you up. It's like, you know, there's this line in the book where like Henry's saying like, you know, she's hanging out with Ginn and Dukowski and they're like, they hear some Nick Cave in 1983 or something, and you know, those guys are going, that's so weak, you know? So it's like a high standard that you're dealing with, but you know, these guys were out this was like social revolution, you know? So that's what I don't think a lot. This is why I had to write the book, had to update the book, had to make the film, you know? And, you know, that film, you know, let me tell you, you know, we sent it to Sundance and they didn't put us in Sundance because they like MGC and Black Flag. You know, it's because we were telling like the cultural story, you know, about subculture in the Reagan era. And
it freaked people out in the 80s and continued to upset people hearing about it, you know, 20 years later in the 2000s. And you know, the story of Black Flag is repeated or echoed in different ways. You focus on regional scenes, you know, but you also focus on basically four big bands in the book that get either whole chapters or most of a chapter devoted to them. You've got Black Flag, the Bad Brains from D.C., and then they moved to New York. You've got the Dead Kennedys almost getting their own chapter out of San Francisco. Then you've got Minor Threat in D.C., and then the Misfits get a chapter. And Misfits is a perfectly apt name. I mean, they definitely did not fit in with that scene. But each of those bands, I mean, it's easy for us at the time. It seemed ridiculous to think that any band out of this scene could get popular. But if you really look at the histories of these bands, each one of them in their own way flirted with popularity and made decisions that, from a careerist point of view, sabotaged the band. I mean, the Bad Brains are the most infamous example of that, where they almost signed with Island Records. They were supposed to go out on tour with U2, but the singer HR is having this struggle where he wants to play reggae and has converted into Rastafarianism and is struggling with schizophrenia, which we didn't know at the time. And this erratic behavior that continues to sabotage him. And, you know, again, with the Dead Kennedys, they have they put an H.R. Geiger poster in one of their albums, and, you know, the Parents Music Research Council is formed basically to shut them down. You know, each of these bands had their own Waterloo, and almost all of them were self-inflicted. And before we start talking about Minor Threat, I want to play Minor Threat's Cashing In, which is a tongue-in-cheek parody of the kind of struggles they were going through and the kind of accusations they were facing from fans who felt that they were selling out. So here's Minor Threat's Cashing In. And that was Minor Threat's Cashing In, with Ian MacKaye's tongue-in-cheek and ironic references to selling out. And this is at a time when the rest of the band is trying to learn U2 songs and thinking big. I mean, they were always a very tight, musically excellent band, but Ian didn't want to go that way, and it tore apart.
Yes, it was funny. There really were two factions to that. Well, because let's be serious. That's Ian MacKaye's band, period. But since he was so democratic about it, or benevolent about it, he shares the bounty equally, which I think is probably the right thing to do. It's clearly the right thing to do, but in terms of the spirit of your group. But and one of them went on to become like a major rock guitarist, and another one became a lawyer. So that was one wing of the band who, like you said, were trying to become rock stars. They were trying to play with Glenn Danzig in a super group that didn't really work, that turned into Samhain.
They did an album with Tesco V of the Meat Men, wore the super bikes.
Yeah.
Absolutely the biggest disappointment of my mail order music fan career.
Yeah, I saw that band. I actually saw them play. That was it was quite a scene. But you know, the one thing was is that there was one wig of that band that really did, you know, want rock stardom, which is the guitarist who created this, you know, incredible guitar sound, no doubt about it. But you know, we talk about the bar being set high. You know, they, like we saw in the movie, that they hung out with the Bad Brains, and you know, the Bad Brains would practice and play, and then hand the bass and the guitars over to them and say, "Here, you guys, now you guys practice."
And,
you know,
yeah, and
you better deliver.
Set the scene on the Bad Brains a little bit, because you know, for a scene that was so white, and you know, there's quotes in the book of people that sort of prided themselves that this was a scene where we didn't have to feel guilty that we were stealing music from black people, which is true in a way, but on the other hand, arguably the architects of the hardcore sound are the Bad Brains, who are an African American group from DC, who are a jazz fusion band that is converted to punk.
What I would say is that The Bad Brains really embody the American experience. You know, I'm
absolutely.
You know, I'm interested in, I love the fact that like one of the greatest golfers was Tiger Woods, or one of the greatest rappers were the Beastie Boys and Eminem. You know, it's like that's America. You know, that's what rock and roll was. It was a mix of, you know, blues was a mix of European instruments and slave music, and rock and roll was a mix of white music with, you know, the rhythm and blues. So it's all about the gray area. The Bad Brains grew up in the suburbs of DC, and they were, you know, most of them, two of them were grew up in the army, you know, traveled the country. You know, they were pretty worldly, open-minded guys. They were listening to like jazz fusion, you know, which is not jazz, you know, those are like the white guys playing the jazz, you know, so they were, you know, they learned about Rastafarianism, and they learned about Bob Marley and all that through punk rock, which kind of segue between each other on the, that was also chronological too, because it was kind of like, you know, there was a lot of connections between Jamaican music and British punk music, you know, from ska to chronologically, meaning that reggae, Bob Marley was actually the last music before punk, kind of, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
It just all kind of fit, you know, the whole thing just kind of fit, and they were ripe for it, and they were the greatest band, you know, you'd ever seen. We're talking about these bands being their worst enemies. Then you get into the sort of business of music. And I used to always hate, I'm not going to name any names, but like guys I know who came from underground, who became super big rock stars and kind of disappeared. But I moved on to new friends, etc. But you know what? I get it now, because you need somebody to protect you from yourselves and from everyone else, you know? And like, you know, no one knew until recently, like, you know, what assholes the Eagles were, or, you know, some band like that. You know, these were horrible. You know, if these guys were like in a hardcore scene where there was no managers and publicists and all that stuff around it, you know, everybody would have that feeling about them. Yeah, you know, wouldn't have the same feeling about them.
Yeah,
you know?
But so, of course, without all the money and cocaine and bodyguards, they might not have been such horrible people.
Right. No, I'm saying I'm not. I still like, you know, I actually like read this thing about Fleetwood Mac. It was this story about the Rumours album, and like how that was all about just, you know, affairs and coke and, you know, like all these things. So I was like, let me check that out again. And it was just as dreadful as I remembered it, you know?
Yeah.
I remember, like, you know, I was telling somebody, like, why did you hate all these bands so much? It was like, and I said, you know what? A lot of times it probably wasn't even the band. It was just like, you know, you heard it a million times. You know,
yeah,
like I know every note of Dark Side of the Moon. I could tell you every note on that album, and I've never owned it or anything. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, just that's hanging out.
People don't understand now. I mean, you know, I recently came across the performer Flo Rida and had never heard of him, and was watching a video about biggest selling artists through the decades. And this is one of the biggest selling artists, musical artists of the 2010s. I'd never heard of him. In the 80s, if somebody had a major hit, your grandmother heard of him. You know, Boy George was big in 83, and boom, everybody has to deal with Boy George because it's on the radio, it's on MTV, it's playing in the grocery stores. The omnipresence of pop music culture in the 70s and 80s cannot be understated, and that's what hardcore was reacting so violently against. And, you know, that's another thing why I appreciate the book, because millennials and younger have these fond feelings about Journey and you know, the Eagles and all this stuff, because, you know, on the musical merits, maybe there's something to it. It's hard for me to appreciate that, but they didn't have it rammed down their throat, or they heard it when they were little tiny kids. So they associate it with comfort and home and family and fun. And in the 80s, that was just not the case. You associated that music with the jocks who were beating you up every day. And
pretty much. There was, I was just about to interject that, like, last night I was watching TV and they had, like, Donny Osmond selling some Time Life music of the 70s set. And I was actually amazed that the music was worse than I remembered it. It was like, you know, like these kind of deep top 40 songs that I used to memorize on Casey Kasem when I was 10 years old. You know, like Pina Colada era songs.
Yacht Rock.
I mean, it's worse than I remember. It's actually worse. They look worse. They look terrible. These are ugly bands too. I mean, I'm not like,
that was a period when
not being attractive, but they're ghastly looking. Their hair's terrible. Their clothes are terrible. Their music's thin. It's vapid. I mean, I don't even know where else to go with it.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't want to get it's sort of the project of the show is not to get into aesthetic arguments, but I think to talk about hardcore, you have to understand it as a reactionary movement. And that's been one of the things, as somebody who grew up with punk and then reconciled myself with metal in my early 20s and played in sort of grunge influenced bands in Austin in the early 90s. I sort of feel guilty that I was into hip hop a little bit, but I was completely deaf to dance music. I mean, I was going to dance clubs and trying to score drugs and get laid, but I was not paying any attention to what this music was. It was just synthesizers and drum machines booming, you know? But now in retrospect, it's easy to see where guitar bands were this retrograde reactionary thing. And we were not on the cutting edge of music. You know, we were expressing maybe a cutting edge of culture, but we weren't musically innovative in a way that, say, the EDM or, you know, the early techno guys were, definitely the hip hop artists were. And when you see how grunge and the punk revival was co-opted by the system once it finally did, you know, explode into the mass consciousness, it's very disheartening. And I think, you know, I really appreciate the book for documenting this movement when it was pure and when it did mean something, and the struggles that people had to go through. And it wasn't just the Fleetwood Mac fans. It was also the what we called new waivers at the time. And people, you know, in Austin, we had the new sincerity scene, and there were these bands like Zeitgeist and True Believers and that had record company interests.
I couldn't get with that.
Yeah, no, it was...
So you did remember, when you talked about metal and punk and Texas, it reminded me of this amazing night I was hanging out with the Butthole Surfers when they were still living in San Antonio, and they brought me to see this band Watchtower.
Yes.
Which, if you remember, is like...
Yes, became early, Dangerous Toys eventually.
Yeah, it became Dangerous Toys, right. But they were on that that Butthole Surfers compilation record with the Dicks and all Really Red and all those bands.
Yeah.
Cottage Cheese from the Lips of Death, I believe it was called.
Yes.
And so I do, that was a really kind of a, that was a pretty cool band. I remember that. But it was, you know, the hardcore was like music was almost like, it wasn't, of course it was all about the music, right? You know, but it was not about like the richness of the music or the tonality of the music or the crispness of the music, or was the singer lisping, or, is it muddled? Or it was just so amazing that you could make something so low tech and just put it out. I was just so amazed by that. You know, I went through this long thing of talking about history of, you know, how of the, all this major rock music. And this was like just screaming to do the opposite. And I think that's why we still talk about it, because it was so radical.
And
it was
powerful.
So radical, man. It was like, yeah, I mean, this is like, you know, this is why, like, people, you know, I don't want to get too political about it, but, you know, there's certain movements that, you know, kind of sit on the under, you know, it just kind of gurgles on the edges for a while until it hits the mainstream. So,
I think the best analog, in American music history to hardcore is actually be jazz bebop, when Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and other guys got tired of basically corny white guys trying to sit in with them and decided to make the music so complicated that unless you were down and really, really, really good, you could not play with them. And it was an intellectual movement sort of presaging black separatism and this declaration that we are artists and we're intellectuals. And hardcore is different in that it was musically the opposite of that, but it was a self segregation. It was people saying, we are opting out of this system. We are not going to be part of your system, and we're going to still make music, and we're still going to communicate with people that are like-minded. And eventually you're going to have
college and going like, there's this album by Billions of Dead Cops that had just come out. And I'm like, you know, which way do I go? Do I like, do I become a lawyer, or do I go like the direction that this record's leading me? You know, and I obviously chose the latter, you know.
Yeah.
But it was. I remember that clearly at the time. I mean, it was like really just like, you know, are you in? Do you buy into Black Flag? You know, are you in on the Bad Brains? You know, do you believe, you know, I mean, I just thought the last, I was around for went to and hung out at a couple recent Danzig shows and the Misfits shows, I'm sorry. And, you know, I've heard feedback, you know, from lots of people, but it's like, let me tell you, the backstage, the band was in great spirits. It was like the first hardcore band to ever sell out an arena like that, like an old school band.
Yeah.
First old school punk band to sell out an arena. And it was like, it was deep. It was like, it was part of our history. You know, there's 18,000 people in those skulls, crimson skull, whatever they're called, shirts. You know, it's deep. It's like you're part of, you know, you're part of something that's so much deeper than music. That's why I have trouble, you know. I mean, I think it kind of wrecked me in many ways, because like we said, the bar was so high for doing the right thing with your, you know, it wasn't only music. It was like, how do you handle yourself?
Exactly.
Like,
and that's
your beliefs.
Well, I'm glad you brought up MDC, because they were an Austin band called The Stains. They changed their name to MDC, you know, Millions of Dead Cops, Multi-Death Corporation. They had, you know, many variations of what the acronym stood for. But they were deeply involved in one of the incidents that was the Bad Brains Waterloo. And the Bad Brains are these, you know, middle-class, open-minded kids who get into first a self-help book called Think and Grow Rich and really use that to power their music and their project, but also show this propensity for believing sort of cult mentality stuff. Then they get into Rastafarianism and go all in and adopt the homophobia of Rastafarianism and have this unfortunate collision in Austin with the Big Boys, who had an openly gay lead singer. The Dicks had an openly gay lead singer. The Stains have an openly gay lead singer. Get into this stupid-ass confrontation over a $25 pot deal. Yeah. And MDC then evangelizes against them around the country for years after that. And in Austin to this day, if you get old punkers together, the Bad Brains are still very controversial, which is painful because they were such a great band, and yet it's impossible to hear the tales of the things that HR did to people without understanding why people are still pissed.
I mean, if fight your own battles is really how I look at it. You know, it's like if you know, that battle was not led by the Big Boys. be noticed.
No, absolutely not. You know? Tim Kerr is, you know, a huge inspiration to the scene and somebody great, I've admired great. For about years and you know, just a great guy. I mean, he's just been a linchpin of the scene. And he, you know, reading his account of that incident is so painful because he was clearly knew he was caught in the middle of this crossfire, that it was stupid, that it was self-defeating. He loved the Bad Brains music, but he has to, you know, once it's a fight, you have to choose sides. He's got to go with his band, his singer, you know, in the face of the stupid bigotry on the part of the Bad Brains. But let's play our last song, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about the metal crossover and kind of the end of hardcore before we wrap. But this is the Bad Brains' Sacred Love. This is from their mid-80s SST album, Eye Against Eye, where they had Ron St. Germain, big-time production, and still had to record a song with the vocalist in jail. So this is Sacred Love by the Bad Brains. And that was the Bad Brains' Sacred Love from their SST album, Eye Against Eye. And, you know, you hear that, you heard it at the time. I remember that just blowing a hole through our high school. I mean, that was one of the first punk records where we could play it for our metalhead friends. And there was none of this, oh, we apologize because it's kind of wimpy, or this is sloppy, or this is doesn't mean. I mean, the heavy metal guys immediately got it. It just blew people away. And, you know, we never heard the rumors that they were going to sign with Island or tour with U2. I mean, you know, we just had this album and never knew why they didn't come touring, you know. And as it turns out, they self-sabotage. But at the same time, metal is, you know, metal was initially very anti-punk. You have a quote from one of the guys in Iron Maiden talking about how they resented being called the new wave of heavy metal. You know, that they didn't want to be associated with punk. But by the mid-80s, you've got bands like Metallica and Slayer that are, you know, Kerry King would have a DK sticker on his guitar. They covered, you know, Guilty of Being White in a bad way. You know, they changed the lyrics to make it was already iffy if you didn't understand the context of being, you know, the only white kid in a school in DC, and they basically turn it into a racist statement, you know. And so that was kind of one of the signals of the death of hardcore, was when so many bands like DRI does an album called Crossover and goes metal. Corrosion of Conformity goes metal. Other bands like Husker Du sign with major label and are trying to go pop. Like, can you give us a quick summation of that end of hardcore?
Right. So you get, you know, for half a decade, you have this incredible ferment of unity and revolution, and of like any movement, it kind of fritters away, and people grow up, and this had a lot to do with it. You get better at your instrument. Do you want to be a singer-songwriter, if you will, like a Bob Mould, or did you want to become a metal god with this new metal that you learn, be it SSD Control in Boston or COC in Carolina or DRI, and basically you'd move to San Francisco at that point. I guess they were from Houston, if I remember.
Yeah, they're a Houston band, definitely.
I saw them in Houston, yeah. But I think they played one of the shows I was at then. I used to like them. But anyway, so regardless, there was like these two different directions you were going to go. And nobody really stayed the course. So Ian MacKaye didn't stay the course, you know.
He was committed to the ideals, but he didn't musically fall away from people.
Right. They're still the same people, but, you know, you kind of, it's like, what do you want from life, right? You're like, what direction do you want to go? You know, you're your own individual. So some people went one way, some people went another way. Nobody seemed to like either of them, which spurred on a second wave, which I guess probably starts with in New York with Agnostic Front and the Chrome Mags. sick of it all, you know, it starts. So
absolutely.
And Gorilla Biscuits guys who are believers, these are the believers, you know, these weren't the pioneers. So it's, I compare it a lot to Jesus, a lot of this, because it's like, these are the followers, you know, the, there's
the apostles going out
to the New Testament that weren't written to like 100+ years after Jesus's death. So yeah. You can imagine the stuff they were coming up with, you know, that's a long time back then. And so I, you know, that was kind of like my feeling about hardcore, was that the history hadn't really been told. So it was almost like a game of telephone. You know, like people hadn't really known it, which is my inspiration on all this. But anyway, so this whole thing comes crashing down. You know, I've had some people say, like, oh, why do you say 1986? It's over. Well, Minor Threat breaks up. Black Flag breaks up. Dead Kennedys break up. This is all 86. You know, 86 is that tremendous kind of crossover record of Eye Against Eye by the Bad Brains. You know, 86 is, you know, Danzig's first album. It's the start of
Sam Haines. I think it was Sam Haines.
Sam Haines, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're seeing something different there. And 86 is, you know, is really where the crossover happens with, you know, incredible records by Slayer, Slayer, Metallica.
Yeah, Rain and Blood comes out in 86.
And to a lesser degree, Anthrax all had these really good records, you know, and they were definitely into punk.
And I mean, Stormtroopers of Death, punk, the Anthrax spinoff band.
Yeah, right. There you go. Perfect. Record. Yeah, that's the angle. That's the angle of hardcore, 100%. So, you know, this whole thing's going on. I was on a few dates of the Slayer Rain and Blood tour. And I got to say, it reminded me of one of those Dead Kennedys tours in terms of the ultra violence, you know?
Yes.
So I really felt the connection to all that stuff. A big moment was there was one of these Black Flag shows in 1986 is in New Jersey. And the band playing the next night at the club down the street is Metallica, who were on a record label called Megaforce, which was in that same area. So they were at the show, and I could tell, and you know, there's a part of it in the book that talks about, you know, a few people who were there, but you know, you could tell that they had were just starting to see this thing. They were just starting to get that there's like this whole other world out there beyond metal, you know, and very soon after that, they no longer had the poodle hair, you know, or the bullet belt. You know what I'm saying? They, you know, they understood the power of this stuff. You know, they'd go see like, you know, Cro-Mags or something. And then, you know, there's no going back after that.
Yeah.
Can't go back to Journey solos after seeing like, you know, seeing Cro-Mags and Agnostic Front.
You can't go back to the Kids Will Have Their Say after seeing Slayer or Metallica either. And like you say, you know, once SSD learned how to play, they, you know, weren't the same band. Once Vinny Stigma started getting real guitarist overdub his parts and openly miming on stage, you know, it's just a different thing. So, Stephen, this has been great talking about American hardcore. It's a massive history. We could talk about it for hours and hours. I definitely recommend the book and movie to anybody who hasn't read or seen it. And thanks for coming on, and hope we can have you back to talk about hair metal, which you're also the historian of.
Yes, you could learn more about my roots, so to speak.
Awesome. Thanks so much,
Steven. It's
really
been a pleasure. Yeah, it's been really great.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Nate will be back next week with Susan Whitehall to discuss the women of Motown. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to all the other great Pantheon podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. American Hardcore, A Tribal History is published by Feral House. Please support our show by ordering via the Amazon referral link on our website, letitrollpodcast.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.